tell me about these again.
Yep. So this is basically where it all started. This is where CarbFix was developed. This was the initial pilot injection well. Now we're using it to inject CO2 coming from Climeworks' direct air capture plant.
So essentially this is an oversized soda stream machine making carbonated water.
Awesome.
But the important thing here is this kind of system, it can work in other industries as well, not only geothermal power. It can work in, you know, cement manufacturing or production of steel or coal-fired power plants. Wherever you have like a very highly concentrated source of CO2, you can actually capture it in water and inject it if you're lucky enough to be sitting on top of favorable bedrock like we are.
Okay, here I am outside the Hellisheiði geothermal plant in Iceland, just outside Reykjavik. It's dark, it's cold. What you just heard was the sound of our guest today, Kari Helgason, the head of research and innovation for CarbFix, who'll tell us about their CO2 storage technology, where they'll take CO2 from any source and inject it underground where it mineralizes or turns to rock under the subsurface in Iceland here. Fascinating topic. Really enjoyed our conversation. Stay with us. As always, BDF does not provide investment or strategy advice. You can hear the full disclaimer at the end of the show. I'm Mark Taylor from a rock field in Iceland, and you're listening to Switched On, the BDF podcast. Hey, Kari. So thank you so much for joining us. This is really awesome. We're standing here at the injection site for the first CarbFix project that started back in 2006. How about we just start with the project itself? Can you tell us a bit about CarbFix and where it kind of came from?
It originally came from, well, a scientist in the United States called Wally Brooker. He came here and he was one of the guys who sort of raised awareness about climate change being a threat, like back in the 70s. He came here to Iceland, talked to Icelandic scientists, to actually see whether this natural weathering of producing minerals in basalts to curb climate change would be an actual, you know, viable. It started in 2006, the CarbFix project, as an academic and industry collaboration.
So really just as an idea that stemmed into a science project, really.
People didn't know whether this would work or, you know, if we did it, how fast it would work, because, you know, naturally, and this is what happens naturally, is that, you know, nature keeps a lot of carbon in rocks. CO2 is dissolved in rainwater, it seeps through the bedrock and it turns into minerals on a very long time scales. So the question is, would we be able to speed this up to actually make this relevant to carbon capture and sequestration technology? That's where it started, doing the academic work, modeling, simulations, etc. When finally we put it to the test and injected CO2 into the Icelandic basaltic bedrock, we found out that this was actually happening quite fast, and we were mineralizing all the CO2 that we injected in the matter of under 2 years. And this was quite a bit faster than people had expected. And this is sort of how it all got started. And then it only took a few more years for it to be implemented in the power plant we're actually sitting in right now. This is a geothermal power plant, which is green energy, but it still emits CO2. It accumulates right here to around 40,000 tons of CO2 per year. And we are currently taking 30% of that CO2 using the CarbFix technology and injecting it. And we'll be scaling that up in the next year to make this a, you know, full-scale carbon capture and storage decarbonized plant.
Let's go back, though, just for a second. Was there an aha moment? Did you know, before you started injecting CO2 underground here, in the lab, did you see that it was going to mineralize, or did you know it was going to happen before you did it?
Well, back then I wasn't working for the company, so I can speak to the for the people that were here. For example, at the Aratotera, at the CEO of the CarbFix company, she had run models that actually indicated that this would be quite fast. Okay. People didn't necessarily believe the models, and I don't think we should always believe models. For sure, they're just to inform, but her models were actually quite a bit accurate when you compared it to the experimental data that, you know, after the pilot injections. I think the aha moment, or the real breakthrough, was that, you know, when we actually demonstrated and verified the mineral storage of CO2 being this efficient. So we had actually succeeded in accelerating nature's way of storing carbon.
That's really cool. So how did the project itself materialize? You started off with the CO2 from the geothermal plant, and then came along the direct air capture idea from Climeworks, or how did that whole arrangement happen?
We started with the power plant, or okay, decarbonizing the power plant. That was what was implemented on industrial scale in 2014. Then we, you know, were introduced to these guys at Climeworks, which is a Swiss company that has this direct air capture technology. And they were, you know, looking for a place to test their pilot unit. They had been developing this technology in Switzerland. And we, in I think it was in 2017, when they actually shipped their pilot unit here. And so they exposed it to the harsh conditions in Iceland, the weather, the corrosion, the you know, the hydrogen sulfide and all the geothermal gases that surround us, and put it, you know, through a stress test for several years. And they actually just scaled up this year, commissioning the first commercial direct air capture and storage plant. So their pilot had been running for at least 3 years before they decided to scale up. But now this has become the first, the world's first commercial direct air capture and storage chain. So we take the CO2 out of the atmosphere and we inject it into the bedrock, where it turns into stone.
Okay, so I don't want to spend too much time on direct air capture, but to me, like, I've been wanting somebody to tell me I'm wrong about this, that I think direct air capture is really interesting because two things. One is location, right? Because in carbon capture and storage, often you don't have the point source of CO2 emissions near the storage location or the sink for the CO2. So that's a big problem. The second issue is verification, right? It's the value of a ton of CO2 stored or offset. And so there's going to come a point when, well, we can't verify all the grass growing in the tundra to offset the emissions through forestry or something like that, or, you know, forests are burning in various parts of the world. And so you're going to need to be able to verify a ton of CO2 stored. So I think, you know, direct air capture plus what Carbfix is doing is really cool. So am I crazy?
No, you're absolutely right in that everything is measurable to the gram of CO2, and it's very traceable and it's very transparent, and you know exactly what is happening, what is being captured, what is going into the ground, and you're doing this in real time. With forestry, there are big uncertainties. It takes a long time for the carbon to be sequestered, and you need a lot of land space. But, you know, don't get me wrong, I mean, we do need these natural solutions as well. We do need to plant a lot of trees, and we also need these technological solutions. We need direct air capture technologies to be at the gigaton scale by mid-century. I mean, that is, if we are to meet our climate goals, that is what we need to do. So we need to do both hand in hand at the same time. We also have to be comfortable with some uncertainty. You know, if we know that we are sequestering CO2, we don't know to the gram, but we just have to do it nevertheless. But this is also what all this research is about, you know, just getting more knowledge and understanding of our natural system in order for us to know better what we need to do and to prioritize what solutions we should fund and which ones we should not.
So just to make sure we got it, we talked about it briefly at the site, but let's just make sure we got it. Can you explain really how the technology works? You mentioned that you take the CO2 and you combine it with water, and then you combine it with some other chemicals, I believe, and inject it in the ground, or no?
No, we just use CO2 and water.
There you go.
So it's just like nature, but accelerating it. We dissolve the CO2 in water. We inject it into the bedrock, and when it enters the formation, the CO2 is completely dissolved. So it's like, you know, a bottle of soda, right? You don't see any bubbles until you open it and depressurize it. Well, underground, there is pressure and it keeps the CO2 in solution. So it doesn't want to leak up. It doesn't want to go anywhere. And it actually has the tendency to sink rather than to rise because the fluid is denser than the surrounding water. So we kill the buoyancy that way. And what happens when the acidic fluid, because this is essentially carbonic acid, just like, you know, sparkling water, what happens is that it starts attacking the rock and dissolving the rock because it's acidic. And the Icelandic bedrock, or basalts in particular, are very rich in metals such as calcium, magnesium, and iron. And it releases these metals into the fluid. And then the chemistry starts happening, that the mineral starts forming. And we start forming magnesium carbonates, calcium carbonates, and iron carbonates. So this is what we mean when we say we turn CO2 into stone. We are turning them into solid carbonate minerals. And once we have verified that these minerals do form, then we can simply walk away and we don't need to monitor anything else in the reservoir.
That's really cool. Years ago, I was a carbon capture analyst, and the big concern everybody had was that once you injected the CO2, you had to monitor it for 100 years to make sure that the CO2 stayed underground. It seems like you don't have that issue.
We do not have that issue because we kill the buoyancy, as I said, by dissolving it in water. And then when it's solid, we don't have to do anything. So you just have to verify that it happens. But we are also in a different position as the conventional CCS or carbon capture and storage projects, in which they are injecting actually supercritical CO2 very, very deep into depleted oil or gas reservoirs. These are typically not located, these geologies are typically not located where basalts and reactive rocks like we are using are located. So actually, we think of it as Carbfix is actually just unlocking a lot of areas in the world where carbon capture and storage hasn't even been considered. We've had instances where we're talking to emitters and they just simply don't know that they're sitting on top of a very favorable bedrock for, you know, storing CO2. So we are just trying to get the word out there, and we have like a mineral storage atlas on our website where people can actually just go and look where are these favorable regions.
Well, give us a rundown. Like what? So we know Iceland. You mentioned all the world's emissions could be stored in Iceland.
Yeah.
But where else?
For example, India, Japan, West Coast United States, and a lot of the seafloor as well. That's mostly basalt. Basalts and these reactive rock formations are found in every continent. They cover around 5% of all the landmass on Earth. So it's the most common rock type on Earth, and it's found in many, many countries. The list goes on. But the important thing is also, it's not only that it's widespread, it's also that this also works in industries outside the geothermal and direct air capture. So we could hook up to cement manufacturing, steel manufacturing, and even fossil fuel fire power plants. So wherever you have concentrated stream of CO2, you can capture it, dissolve it in water, and inject for storage.
Is the idea for Carbfix as a company, not a science project as it was back in 06, is it to go to emitters in India, Japan, South Africa, Ethiopia, wherever, and take their CO2 and inject it right under their feet? Or is it something else?
This is always the most economical way to go. I think it's important that we have demonstrated it here, that, you know, we're running this whole CCS chain at about $25 per ton. And that is actually very economical. It's way lower than the current ETS emission allowances are selling for.
And it's lower than the tax credit in the US?
That's right. But I will give you, these are somewhat idealized conditions. Sure. Where we are. But this is always the most economical way to go, and it lowers the entry barrier into CCS, because really CCS up till now has only been done by governments and big oil and gas. But now you can actually, you know, go to a medium-sized enterprise, which is, you know, producing cement, for example, and implement this technology there. So that's one pathway. Another pathway is direct air capture, like we're demonstrating here. And for that, you only need the bedrock and the energy that it demands. And the third, and I think this will be the most important pathway for CCS, is, you know, establishing these storage hubs or industrial clusters where you have a lot of injection capacity and where you can actually ship the CO2 either by ship or pipeline. So that, you know, you have these concentrated clusters where either we have to build up transport network to transport the CO2 to the favorable storage sites, or we simply have to build the industries next to these storage sites. I mean, I think the future will be a combination of both. For example, here in Iceland, we are starting to demonstrate this storage hub concept by a project called the Kota Terminal. And we are planning to ship in liquidized CO2 on tankers from Northern Europe for operation in 2025. So
it's quite soon.
Yeah, it's relatively soon. We have a lot to do still. Yeah. But I think once we have demonstrated the mineral storage hub concept here in Iceland, then it will be ready for applications in strategic locations around the world where they have actually much more emissions than we do here in Iceland. In Iceland, we really, you know, we're lacking the CO2. We have the rocks, we have the water, but we don't have the CO2.
Right, right.
But this is where you know, carbon capture and storage can reach these climate relevant scales by building up these hubs. And we're by no means the only ones doing it in Europe. There is Project Longship in Norway. There are other CCS projects. And the European Union is dead serious when they are saying that we are building up these carbon transport networks. And we simply are going to be one node in this network. We need to transform our infrastructure, right? In Iceland, we transformed the infrastructure in relation to geothermal, like in the district heating. We used to be an oil country. So now we need yet another transformation of the infrastructure to actually transport CO2. We need oil in reverse,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And people always tell me, when I tell them about this Coda Terminal project, in which we are, you know, shipping CO2 from Europe. It sounds sci-fi, right? Capturing CO2, liquidizing it, putting it on a ship, shipping it all the way to Iceland for, you know, this economic permanent storage. But, you know, how sci-fi is the oil and gas infrastructure? If you think about it, I mean, it's crazy infrastructure. You know, you're pumping up so much fossil fuels from deep underground, you know, you're putting in our tank ships and you're shipping it all the way to the world on all these petrol stations.
Into different materials.
Exactly. It is crazy infrastructure. And you're shipping it like, you know, halfway across the world. And now we are shipping CO2 like from Northern Europe to Iceland. I mean, that's nothing. I mean, the point I'm trying to make is like, it was crazy infrastructure that got us into this mess in the first place. And we need big solutions to get us out of this mess.
So I realize the Coda Terminal has to be your big priority right now, but is there another country besides Iceland that you're looking for another demonstration or scale-up project for another cluster or hub?
People tell us with the Coda Terminal, it's like, you know, can you get any bigger? So we're already, really? You know, looking at Coda Terminal 2.0, perhaps in Iceland.
I tell you what sounds sci-fi to me is when you said, when we were at the site, that Iceland, you know, it's an island, right? That you said it could house all of the CO2, you know, created by mankind. Like, that number sounds just unfathomable to me. But I get it. If Iceland can take it, then maybe that's the industry. Maybe the Coda Terminal 2.0, 3.0 is the answer. Maybe just ship it all here and Iceland becomes the sink for the world.
It's going to depend a lot on how economic we can make the transport link in right. The CCS chain. So, I mean, Iceland is, you know, admittedly far away, but the economics work because the storage is so cheap. We are doing it onshore as opposed to offshore, where things are usually 10 times more expensive. And we are using low-cost, low-risk approach to, you know, expanding. We're using multiple shallow injection wells instead of like one ginormous deep injection well.
And they're not special wells, are they? You're not looking for a reservoir or anything, I assume. I mean, you're looking for basalt, but basalt.
I mean, you know, not all basalt is
okay,
is equal.
Fine,
I mean, we prefer to be in like young, fresh basalt, you know, just to make things easier and you know, because we have demonstrated it here. There are older and more altered basalts that can sequester carbon for sure. But when we're talking about these big scale projects that, you know, haven't been demonstrated before, we will start out in our comfort zone for sure.
Okay.
But for the hubs in the other places in the world, you know, that remains to be seen where we should actually place them. And it depends on many other things than geology. It's also politics, permitting, financing, interest, etc. that goes into the equation here.
Well, let's go to that. We talked about the source or the sink under my feet. You just announced yesterday, October 26th, and we're recording this on the 27th, that you are going to start storing CO2 from their, what is it, ICEL project? ICEL aluminum plant in Iceland here.
Yeah, so the Rio Tinto aluminum smelter in Iceland, it's co-located with the Koto terminal.
Okay.
So they're actually sitting in the same location.
How convenient.
and they're actually sitting on the freshest and nicest basalt for carbon storage that, you know, you can find in Iceland, with a lot of fresh water. So there's everything there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think what, you know, Rio Tinto has just realized is that they are going to have an operating injection site in 2025 right at their doorstep. So it makes sense to develop carbon capture and storage here. Now, carbon capture and storage in the aluminum sector is not easy. The CO2, you know, stream coming from an aluminum production facility is very diluted.
Right, low concentration.
Very low concentration of CO2. But they are working on modifying their processes, getting the concentration up so that they will have a capturable source of CO2 by 2025.
Do you deal with that part, or do you just take the CO2 when it's ready for storage?
We will, you know, facilitate in carbon capture as much as we can.
Pairing minds with minds.
Yeah, we are experts in carbon storage.
Okay.
But we have our complete carbon capture and storage chain here. So at some point, their CO2 concentration will be good enough for us to take over. Maybe we'll have to have an extra module there in between, another technology that, you know, ups the concentrations or purifies it or something like that. But this is, you know, there are several options on the table right now.
Okay. Let's say, congratulations on that. That's really cool. And that you say that's going to go on in likely 2025, is that right?
That's what we're aiming for, yeah.
And just for everybody listening, that's part of Rio Tinto's $7.5 billion announcement they made last week to reduce Scope 1 and 2 emissions by 16.3 million tons per year by 2030. So clearly they had this in mind before they made that announcement. That's an oddly specific number, 16.3 million tons per year. Do you know what proportion or how much they plan to inject or how much this smelter emits?
Well, this smelter emits a little over 300,000 tons per year.
Okay.
So it's a small portion of the 16.3 million.
Yeah. You got the 0.3.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So right when we're done, it will be 16. Well, okay. Hopefully more. Yeah, I mean, we'll see how far we can go. I mean, usually in most industries, these are demonstrated technologies. You can just go and choose a company, choose a service provider, and you can just start doing it. With an aluminum smelter, like I, you know, mentioned, there is R&D involved. So we don't know exactly if they will be ready in 2025 when we will start operating the Koto terminal. But at least we will be there and the storage site will be operational. And we are ready when they are ready.
Okay, I was going to use a hypothetical company as an example, but I'm going to use Rio Tinto. Ivan Vella, the CEO, in a story I read from Bloomberg about this, said, quote, "Beyond this project, we will look for opportunities to apply Carbfix's technology for decarbonization across Rio Tinto's operations." All right. So let's say they come to you with a project in Australia, you know, a plant in Australia they want to decarbonize, or a smelter or something like that in Australia. Do you say, great, let's do the storage here? Or do you say, okay, let me find you a ship and we'll take it to a hub, you know, at the Koto terminal?
First, we'll see if we can inject it on site. It's always the cheapest way to go and the most economical way to go. So if for some reason that turns out to be not favorable, and it's not only about the chemistry of the rocks, it's also about the permeability. Can you get all this fluid into the underground? Is there space for it? I mean, this is also a big concern.
I mean, Australia has hot, dry rock. They keep talking about it, right? At least a decade ago they did.
Yeah, but the next step would be like, okay, is this emitter, you know, in a position where it can, you know, ship CO2 or transport it via pipeline or ship to a favorable storage site? This might be like mineral storage, but this could also be like conventional carbon capture and storage site, like the oil and gas industry is doing. So that is the pathway number two. So, and the third pathway, and you should never do this with industrial emission, is direct air capture. So direct air capture, you only offset the emissions that you cannot decarbonize by other means.
Right.
It's important to actually, you know, emphasize this point, because people tend to think about direct air capture and storage as, you know, being a silver bullet, right? You know, oh, you emit this much CO2, you take this much CO2 out of the atmosphere. You know, it's a zero-sum game. But, you know, the most important thing right now is that we need to stop emissions from these concentrated sources. Like, concentrated point sources are like 70% of all the emissions. So we need to put a stop on that right now. And that's an urgent task for us to do now. direct air capture needs to be at scale by mid-century. It's nice to start here in Iceland, to start the development here, and we've demonstrated it, which is, you know, very cool, I think. In 2050, we'll look back and say, oh, this big industry now, it started here. It's kind of cool. Yeah. But I mean, you know, this is a long-distance run, direct air capture. Yeah. Stopping emissions, this is a sprint. We must start this right now.
I couldn't agree more, as a human. But let me ask you another question. So let's say I'm not Rio Tinto. Let's say I'm, I don't know, Microsoft or Stripe, you know, both of which have a beyond or further than net zero, a net negative carbon emission goal. What would you tell them were they to come to you and say, hey, I'd like to offset my CO2 or I'd like to inject a ton of CO2? You said you could measure it to the gram, right, of CO2. That, to me, you know, for my ESG targets, that's really important. What do you tell me?
Yeah, when it comes to carbon capture and storage, I reiterate the importance of stopping emissions from point sources. Now, it's not necessarily, you know, Google's responsibility or Microsoft's responsibility of, you know, stopping emissions from some industry's emissions. I mean, and you know, for example, in Europe, there are, you know, mandatory markets that these industries must comply to, which is, for example, ETS, emission allowances. But typically, Microsoft and these companies, Stripe, they have like a portfolio of solutions. So they are, you know, hedging their bets, and they're really, you know, trying to, you know, kickstart, you know, some great innovations in climate science and in curbing climate change. So this is what they're doing, not only with direct air capture, but also other natural solutions, for example. And I think someone needs to do this, because we know for sure that we will not meet our climate goals without going net zero. So I'm happy that someone is doing it.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's kind of what I've been thinking. Just that maybe, I mean, I know that we weren't going to talk as much about direct air capture, but like that seems to be a legit option for companies like that that have those targets.
It has been a little bit like the game of the chicken and the egg. The industries, they don't want to commit to capture unless they have a place to store things. The storage providers, they don't want to do carbon storage if nobody's going to send them CO2. But I think what we really need now is for governments to facilitate and kickstart this market so that we can deploy faster and finance these projects faster, because we need deployment of them. When you think about the number of tons we have to avoid by mid-century, it's a staggering amount. It's, you know, 1,000 gigatons, something like that. And you know, I know people don't understand what a gigaton is. It is, you know, 1,000 million tons. If you've been to the Gullfoss, one of the biggest waterfalls here in Iceland, you have. Yeah, I mean, we calculated that the average flow of Gullfoss, and you stand there, you see the power, you feel the power there. So much water going down. That the average flow of Gullfoss, that's the amount of CO2 we need to be putting under the ground on average until 2060. So that's just like when you stand there. If I translate it to Niagara Falls.
Better. For a lot of the audience, yeah.
2 years worth of Niagara Falls. Wow. That's the CO2 we need to avoid with carbon capture and storage. So wow. That's like, you know, over 100 gigatons in by 2060, according to International Energy Agency. And just imagine you're just standing next to the Niagara Falls. Yeah. And you're watching all this water, you're watching all this enormous power, and you stand there for 2 years.
Yeah.
And you just watch the water coming down. Replace that with CO2. That's how much we have emitted, you know, and more into the atmosphere since Industrial Revolution. And that's what needs to come back. We need to reverse what we've been doing.
I've never heard a better analogy for CCS and the storage needs. That's amazing. That totally makes sense. Well, on that, I do have one more question. And this is going to be after the fact, but there's a lot going on this week, right, in terms of the U.S. infrastructure bill, and there could be changes to the tax code for carbon storage or CO2 storage underground. Next week is also the COP26 climate negotiations in Glasgow. Are you looking for anything specific to happen in either one of those? You know, the improvements to the tax law in the U.S. or money from countries from the COP meetings?
In an ideal world, I would like to
see... We'll do ideal first and then we'll do realistic.
Oh, yeah. In an ideal world, I would like to see a universal price on carbon emissions.
Okay.
So I understand this is not going to happen at COP26, although we will, hopefully make significant strides, like you said, Article 6. I would say that I really just want these projects to get deployed faster. And the way we do it, I'm not an expert there. I don't want to say the word, tax, but a carbon tax is, something that we know will be effective. Okay. And it's demonstrated to be effective, but and I understand it's politically tough, but I hope that we will, have, a more mature market for carbon. Yeah. Okay. Because shipping CO2 between countries for storage, I mean, this is a big enterprise and it won't happen unless you have, a solid market for it. And we need governments to help us create that market. If we don't, then Carbfix is out of business.
I'm going to disagree slightly in that you have all these companies and countries that are making net zero commitments, right? And you have ESG becoming part of investment requirements, theses, reporting, regulations, things like that. And so if anybody's serious about any of this, you're going to have more companies like Rio Tinto putting $7.6 billion into their net zero goals, right? And part of that is going to involve, CCS or CO2 storage, whatever you want to call it here. I think policies is really, really critical. But in some ways could be a nice to have. I don't know. I think the market could be taking over. I'm not sure.
With big industries, I mean, they are going to move when the carbon price rises. That is for sure. And the ETS emission allowances has been, hovering around 20 euros per ton for a long time. And they've done nothing. Absolutely nothing.
What about 55 now, 60?
Now we're up to 55, 60, and now we're seeing movement. Mm-hmm. So you see this goes hand in hand.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And that is the big industries. And this is, the biggest slice of the cake, really, is when you get these big industries to move, then, you will get real action.
So number of calls you get is directly correlated to the carbon price, it sounds like.
Yeah, more or less.
Kauri, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Pleasure talking to you.
All right, we'll look forward to having you back when Code is built.
Very good. You'll be invited.
Sweet. Oh, I look forward to it. Today's episode of Switched On was edited by Rex Warner of Greystoke Media. Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as, investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed.